Just around the corner from the Roman Colosseum was the vineyard of Felice de Freitas. On January 16, 1506, Felice was working on his field when he stumbled across something. It seemed that there was some kind of statue that was wedged into the soil. Turns out that his vineyard was situated right about where Nero's golden house once stood. So it occurred to old Felice that this statue might be something kind of special. Word got around, and in no time at all, a crowd gathered to watch the excavation. Perhaps the most interested observer was someone who knew a little something about statues when Michelangelo Buonarroti showed up. The hole was widened, and the statue began to emerge. Michelangelo gasped. It wasn't just one statue, but a statue group. At almost 7 feet high, it was three straining, contorted male nudes being attacked by sea serpents. Michelangelo was spellbound, even stupefied with what he saw. The statue group took the Western world by storm. Renaissance art would never be the same. Michelangelo would see to that. Hello and welcome to Snapshots from Europe Travelogue. I'm your host, Brian Unger, providing the historical, cultural, and geographical backstories for some of the greatest destinations in Europe to help you get a fuller appreciation for these places when you visit. In part one of our Rome podcast, we did a tour through Imperial Rome when it had a population of 1 million people and it ruled over 90 million people as the capital of the Roman Empire. The city was clothed in marble. This glorious metropolis was dubbed the Eternal City, as it was expected that Rome would live forever. Well, eternal is a long time, and if we fast forward to the 15th century, the so-called Eternal City had become a shadow of its former self. The skyline was littered with the ruins of once spectacular structures. Wild animals ran free through the overgrowth that dominated the center of the city. The once glorious Roman Forum was literally a cow pasture. And the population? Maybe 25,000 people now? This was not the Rome of Caesar Augustus. But that was about to change. Rome was about to experience a rebirth, a renaissance. And when you visit, that will add a magnificent layer to your Roman experience. In part one, we did the Caesar Shuffle through Imperial Rome and highlighted 10 sites to help you get a feel for the glories of the Eternal City. Now, Renaissance Rome offers an entirely different scope of highlights, mostly of an artistic nature, and that's what we're going to focus on in part two. So let's get into some of the backstories that will help to equip you for a Renaissance ramble through Rome. Back in the days of the Caesars, Rome was the most glorious city in the world. But by the 15th century, it was kind of in the doldrums, and there's a couple of reasons why. In the year 330, Emperor Constantine moved the imperial capital of the Roman Empire to Constantinople, and that was a huge hit to the prestige of Rome. In the 5th century, the unthinkable happened when the Eternal City was sacked a couple of times by Visigoths and the very aptly named Vandals, which led to the official fall of the Roman Empire. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to work out where we get the word vandalism from. Through it all, the seat of the Pope of the Roman Catholic Church continued to be in Rome, and the city retained a degree of importance in the Christian world because it was home to St. Peter's Basilica, which was built over the grave of St. Peter. But as city-states and emerging nationalism developed through the Middle Ages, rulers in Europe began to wonder why they needed to submit to a pontiff in a foreign land. In fact, in the 14th century, a Frenchman was elected as pope, and he moved his court from Rome to Avignon in the south of France with the sponsorship of the King of France. The papal court stayed there for nearly 30 years before it moved back, but this only reinforced the feeling that Rome had lost a lot of prestige and cachet, and the credibility of the Roman Catholic Church was severely damaged. Somehow, Rome needed a boost. It needed some good PR. Well, in 1471, Pope Paul II died unexpectedly. So the College of Cardinals elected Francesco della Rovere as the new pope in the year 1471. Francesco adopted the name Sixtus, which was a curious choice because that name hadn't been used since the 5th century. And Sixtus went on to have what we'll call an eventful tenure as pope. Here are some of the things he did. He founded the Spanish Inquisition. He declared a crusade against the Ottoman Turks. He sanctioned the rights of the Portuguese to capture and enslave peoples along the west coast of Africa, thereby kicking off the whole slave trade. He signed off on a failed plot to assassinate Lorenzo de' Medici, the ruler of the Florentine Republic. He stacked the church with his supporters by creating 34 new cardinals, far more than his predecessors. Why did he do that? Well, many of his appointees were his nephews. The Italian word for nephew is nepoti, and that's where we get the word nepotism from in the English language. And under Sixtus, nepotism wasn't the only path to becoming a cardinal. According to one Italian historian, Sixtus was, and I quote, "a lover of boys and sodomites," unquote. He awarded benefices and bishoprics in return for sexual favors, and he nominated a number of young men as cardinals based on their good looks. So how does slippery Sixtus factor into the rebirth of Rome? Well, although he was a pretty shady character, he made a priority to restore and enrich Rome. Defense walls were repaired, palaces were built, and churches were renovated. Even the Roman chronicler who commented on Sixtus being a, quote, "lover of boys and sodomites," unquote, even he was impressed. He raved, quote, "you gave your city temples, streets, squares, fortification, bridges, and restored aqueducts," unquote. He built the first new bridge over the Tiber River since the Roman Empire. It was named Ponte Sisto, after Sixtus, and you can cross this beautiful pedestrian bridge today. He brought together artists using fat commissions and outright orders to lure great artists to the city, creating many of the first masterpieces of Rome's new artistic age. Another of his initiatives was to renovate the Vatican, which had become the residence of the Pope since the return of the papal court from France. He started by rebuilding an existing chapel, and he had it named after him. Slippery Pope Sixtus built the Sistine Chapel. It was completed in the year 1480 when Sixtus commissioned many of the greatest artists of the period, including Botticelli and Ghirlandaio, to paint frescoes on the walls. It was looking pretty good, but the ceiling was looking pretty blah. It was painted in blue and it was studded with gilt stars. Which brings us to Michelangelo. Born in 1475 to a small-time Florentine banker, as a young lad, he showed himself to be a precocious young artist. At the age of 13, he began an apprenticeship at an artist workshop in Florence. He eventually made it to the court of the mighty Lorenzo Medici, the guy who Slippery Sixtus tried to assassinate. He moved to Rome in 1496, where he received his first major commission from a high cardinal. At the age of 21, he sculpted Bacchus, the ancient Roman god of wine. Now, this is brilliant. You can see it today in the Bargello Museum in Florence. It's one of my favorite Michelangelos, but it wasn't the cardinals, as he rejected it and he sold it to a banker. Could you imagine? However, this did not stop Michelangelo from getting another job. In 1498, he got a commission from another cardinal to sculpt a Pietà, which is a generic term describing any depiction of the Virgin Mary cradling the dead body of Jesus. Michelangelo's Pietà was supposed to be used for the cardinal's funeral monument, but thankfully it never made it to this guy's grave. You can see it today in St. Peter's Basilica, and it is absolutely one of your must-sees on the Renaissance ramble we hope you can do when you go through Rome. Without doubt, it is one of the most astonishing sculptures in human history. It features a youthful Mary with sad tenderness on her face, cradling the dead body of Christ on her lap. To think of all of that warm, soft emotion on her face being carved from cold, hard marble, it's astonishing. And the slack, lifeless body of Christ conjures up the cadavers that Michelangelo studied as he anticipated this project. A contemporary chronicler of Michelangelo wrote at the time, quote, "These figures emerge from stone as though surfacing from a pool of water," unquote. Now, Michelangelo was only 24 years old when he created the Pietà. When it was put on display, no one could believe that this relative unknown kid from Florence could have created such a breathtaking piece of art. So he did something that he had never done before and would never do again. At night, he broke into the building where the Pietà was displayed, and he carved across Mary's sash, "Michelangelo Buonarroti, Florentine, made this." It is the only one of Michelangelo's works that he signed. So Michelangelo was becoming known as a sculpting prodigy, which is why on that day in January of 1506, he was summoned to the vineyard of Felice de Freitas to witness the archaeological dig I mentioned off the top of this episode. It was well known that a statue from Greek antiquity of uncommon beauty, power, and passion called the Laocoon existed, but somehow it had been lost to history. The story behind the Laocoon is he was a Trojan priest trying to warn the city of Troy about the ruse of the Trojan horse. The Greek god Poseidon intervened by sending sea serpents to kill the Laocoon and his two sons. It was a legendary statue, and the main Roman writer on art, Pliny the Elder, wrote about it in the first century AD, making the bold statement that this was the most amazing statue ever seen in ancient Rome. He called it, quote, "a work to be preferred to all that of the arts of painting and sculpture that have ever been produced," unquote. High praise. As the excavation continued in Felice de Freitas' vineyard and the statue emerged from the dirt, there was a collective gasp. The Laocoon had been found. The human anatomy on this writhing figure is unbelievably lifelike. Every part of the Laocoon's body is straining. Nothing like this had ever been done before or since. It has been described as the prototypical icon of human agony. It made a monumental impression on Michelangelo, and it influenced much of his work. Baroque art, which followed on the heels of the High Renaissance, is passionate and dramatic, and it draws direct inspiration from this amazing statue. Well, the Vatican didn't waste any time. They swooped in immediately to acquire the Laocoon group, and they put it on display in a garden for public viewing. Other statues and works of art were gathered and placed alongside the Laocoon until you could almost call the collection a museum. And that is how the Vatican Museum was born. The acquisition of the Laocoon gave birth to one of the greatest and most popular art collections in the world. In the year 2019, the Vatican Museum hosted nearly 7 million visitors. The Laocoon is prominently displayed as one of the first things you see when you enter the Vatican Museum. See if it makes as much of an impression on you as it made on Michelangelo. Well, let's get back to that Vatican renovation project that Slippery Sixtus had started. The entire complex was really starting to get spruced up, and it was coming along quite nicely. Slippery Sixtus died, and several years later, in 1503, his nephew, Giuliano della Rovere, got the big chair. Was it an accident that Giuliano was the nephew of Sixtus? Remember nepotism? I think not. The first order of new popes, as we said earlier, is to choose a papal name. So Giuliano went with the name Julius, partially because it kind of resembled his birth name, but more so because it reflected his admiration and emulation of Julius Caesar, one of the greatest generals of the Roman Empire. So it's not surprising that Pope Julius soon became known as the Warrior Pope, leading papal armies into battle against various Italian kingdoms. But even more than that, Julius was known to be a ferocious patron of the arts. He started by tackling the chapel that his uncle Sixtus had built and named after him, you know, the Sistine Chapel. The frescoes on the walls of the Sistine were pretty impressive, but that vaulted blue ceiling with the golden stars just didn't look quite right. So he thought he'd spruce it up a bit. So who are you going to call? As the supreme pontiff of the Catholic Church, you could get anyone you wanted. So for Julius, it was a no-brainer. It would have to be Michelangelo. Julius offered him the commission to paint the ceiling, but Michelangelo, as you may know this story, he turned it down. He was very clear. He told Pope Julius he was not a painter, he was a sculptor. But Julius was not going to take no for an answer. He pleaded, he bribed, he threatened, and eventually he bullied Michelangelo into accepting the job. This would be a massive undertaking. The ceiling was almost 6,000 square feet. Before he started the project, he had to design his own scaffolding, and he spent the next 4 years, from 1508 to 1512, six stories up, covering the ceiling with frescoes that show the entire Christian history of the world. Now, have you ever had to change a light fixture? You know how hard it is to hold your arm above your head? How heavy does your arm get? Well, Michelangelo did this for 4 years, which took an enormous physical effort. Paint dripping in his eyes, not to mention the creative drain, and the pushy Pope Julius, who relentlessly badgered Michelangelo to get the thing completed. All of this combined, and it practically killed Michelangelo. But when it was revealed, people were absolutely blown away. This was more dramatic, shocking, and emotional than any of his works that had preceded it. It included 9 scenes from the book of Genesis with more than 300 painted figures. And this was from a guy who didn't even consider himself to be a painter. One thing you'll notice when you view the fresco is that many of Michelangelo's figures are dead ringers for the Laocoon. Even though he was making paintings, Michelangelo was really a sculptor at heart, and it's easy to see the influence of the greatest statue ever made in Michelangelo's work. The ceiling has mesmerized people ever since. In 2019, 6 million people visited the Sistine Chapel, making it one of the most sacred sites in all of Christendom. Many art scholars contend that the Sistine ceiling is the single greatest work of art by any one human being in the history of mankind. That's pretty high praise. Now, I really don't like the term breathtaking. It's thrown around way too lightly. I mean, has anything you've seen in your life literally taken your breath away? Well, I've seen the Sistine ceiling 3 or 4 times. And I got to admit, you almost gasp when you see it, especially for the first time. So if anything in this world might qualify as breathtaking, as far as I'm concerned, the Sistine Chapel comes about as close as it gets. I also hate the term bucket list, but I'm going to use it here. Put the Sistine Chapel on your bucket list. It will probably be the highlight of your Roman Renaissance ramble. Now, as revered as Michelangelo was, he may not have even been the most popular artist of his era. That honor could well be bestowed on a handsome, sophisticated painter who had become a total celebrity in Renaissance Rome. Raphael Santi lived a charmed life. He combined the power of Michelangelo with the elegance of another of his contemporaries, someone who he worshipped, Leonardo da Vinci. Raphael played to his image. He painted while wearing fine clothes. He nibbled fresh fruit, and he even was entertained with live music while he worked. He was a big favorite of princes and popes. Raphael had multiple sexual affairs, but that didn't seem to matter. High society was seduced by his devil-may-care attitude. He was rich, he was famous, he was beloved, and his artwork was spectacular. There are numerous masterpieces that I could direct you to in Rome. You'll probably see some in your travels throughout Rome. But since I've got you going to the Sistine Chapel at the Vatican Museum, be sure to take in Raphael's magnum opus, The School of Athens. This is a fresco, which is a wall painting, just down the hallway from where the Sistine Chapel is. And he was painting it at the exact same time that Michelangelo was working on the ceiling. In fact, Raphael would even pop in on Michelangelo to see how it was going, and he borrowed some of his ideas for this 25-foot by 17-foot masterpiece. It's really very quite large. The reason the School of Athens is such a big deal is because it sums up the spirit of the Renaissance. The massive fresco celebrates 50 different figures from Greek antiquity, including Socrates, Pythagoras, Archimedes, and others, but at the center are Plato pointing up to the realm of ideas and Aristotle pointing down at the tangible world. And the cool thing is, Plato is a portrait of Leonardo da Vinci. As I said, Raphael worshipped him, so he wanted to include Leonardo in his masterpiece, School of Athens. He also painted Michelangelo into the fresco. And for good measure, Raphael even painted himself into the picture, although it's just a very small figure in the bottom right corner, and it's looking directly out at you, the viewer. So it's really fun to pick these figures out when you see the School of Athens. This is a seminal work in the Renaissance because of the statement that it makes, the role models and icons of Western civilization to Raphael and to people of the Renaissance are from a pre-Christian time. It proudly proclaims that humanist philosophy should provide the template for progress in Western civilization. Maybe we need to look to the ancients for answers instead of the church. Raphael continued to dazzle with numerous jaw-dropping paintings, all while maintaining a glamorous playboy lifestyle. So it was with great shock and dismay when he dropped dead in the year 1520 at the young age of 37 years old. Although the cause of death has not been exactly determined, it is known that he died after a night of what was described as, quote, excessive lovemaking, unquote. So I'll leave it to you to speculate on what killed the poor guy. Raphael was so revered, he was buried in the Pantheon, which I mentioned in part one of this episode as my favorite building in all of Europe. So when you visit the Pantheon as part of your Caesar shuffle, don't forget to pay your respects to Raphael, and you can also contemplate exactly how he died. So thanks to Pope Julius and Michelangelo, the Sistine Chapel was looking pretty fresh, but Julius had even bigger plans for the Vatican. Way back in the year 318, St. Peter's Basilica had been commissioned by the Roman Emperor Constantine the Great, and over the years, it had become a major place of pilgrimage for Christians. But now it's the 16th century, and the basilica was more than 1,100 years old, and it was literally falling apart, really unfit to be the center of the Western Church. Well, Julius set out to change all of that. He commissioned the destruction of the old church in order to build the grandest building in all of Christendom. The Roman Catholic Church deserved nothing less. But Julius had another motive. He was also planning an enormous tomb for himself. It was to be a freestanding, three-level structure with some 40 statues. And the sculptor who he commissioned for the job was, of course, Michelangelo. And the enormous new St. Peter's Basilica would be the perfect place to house this monumental tomb. So construction began on St. Peter's Basilica in 1506, but as you can imagine, this is not a short-term project. Over the years, a number of architects, each with their own designs, worked on the basilica. After 120 years, 20 popes, 10 architects, the project was finally completed, and it lived up to its billing. We already have you going into St. Peter's to visit Michelangelo's Pietà, which is prominently displayed on the right side as you enter, but there is so much more to see. In fact, I'd say you don't see the interior of St. Peter's, you experience it. For starters, you'll be amazed at the vast size of the interior. It's an unimaginable 163,000 square feet. Along with the Pietà, another highlight is Bernini's six-story bronze canopy above the altar, but I'll come back to that a little bit later. Another highlight is the 450-foot high dome that was designed by none other than Michelangelo himself. It was at the time, and still is, the tallest dome in the world. The basilica that Pope Julius had commissioned in 1506 would, upon completion, be the largest and greatest church in all of Christendom. How about these for some reviews? The American philosopher Ralph Waldo Emerson described St. Peter's as, quote, an ornament of the earth, the sublime of the beautiful, unquote. Another scholar summed it up pretty well by observing that, quote, St. Peter's Basilica is the reason why Rome is still the center of the civilized world. For religious, historical, and architectural reasons, it by itself justifies a journey to Rome, unquote. St. Peter's will definitely be a centerpiece to your Renaissance ramble through Rome. Needless to say, Julius II, the warrior pope, did not live to see the completion of the basilica. But what about this epic 40-figure, three-level tomb he had commissioned for Michelangelo to build? At the time of Julius's death in 1513, Michelangelo had completed only a handful of statues. And not surprisingly, there wasn't a lot of enthusiasm for this incredibly costly undertaking after Julius died, so the project was shelved. However, the legacy of the tomb of Julius lived on with one amazing sculpture that Michelangelo had completed. It's a massive, larger-than-life statue of a seated Moses. Michelangelo poured his heart and his soul into this statue, and it is considered to be one of his finest. Legend has it that he became so attached to this lifelike statue, while he was working on it late one evening, he screamed at the figure, "Speak!" And when it didn't respond, he smashed the statue on the knee. You can see this mark on the statue when you visit it today. And where can you see the statue? It's on display in San Pietro in Vincoli Church in Rome. And unlike most other Michelangelo masterpieces, this one is free of charge. It's right in the center of the city, so you really don't have an excuse to not see the statue. And I dare you not to scream at Moses to try and make him come alive. Well, Michelangelo always considered himself first and foremost a sculptor and not a painter. He painted the Sistine under duress, and it was probably the best day of his life when he finished the ceiling in the year 1512. In 1535, more than two decades after that ordeal, another pope summoned him to complete his Christian history of the world by painting the final event, the end of time, Judgment Day. Again, Michelangelo was not happy about it, but as was his nature, he threw himself into the project. And seeing as it's Judgment Day, you can imagine that this makes for a pretty grim painting. And sure enough, when you see it, no one's smiling. A clean-shaven Christ is at the center, looking very much like a Greek god, with saints surrounding him. Even Jesus' own mom, Mary, is shrinking back in terror at this terrifying judge. There are more than 300 figures in this fresco, and each one is worthy of your attention. Many of them are twisted figures in varying stages of anguish as they're being dragged into hell. And again, you can see the influence of the Laocoon in Michelangelo's figures. One figure I'd like you to seek out when you take a look at the Last Judgment in the Sistine Chapel is a figure of a damned person being pulled down to hell by a gleeful demon. And the utterly lost expression on the face of the damned is priceless. It's like he's thinking, why did I cheat on my wife? When the Last Judgment was unveiled to the public in 1541, the Pope is said to have dropped to his knees and cried, "Lord, charge me not with my sins on the day of judgment." But not everyone was impressed. One cardinal was very critical of the fresco, saying, quote, "It was the most disgraceful that in such a sacred place there should have been depicted all of those nude figures exposing themselves so shamefully," unquote. He went on to say that the painting would have been more suitable for the public baths and taverns than a papal chapel. Well, Michelangelo was furious, so he went back to do a little retouching of his masterpiece. He worked the cardinal's face into the scene as Minos, the judge of the underworld, with donkey ears and a coiled snake covering the private parts of his nude body. It's in the bottom right-hand corner of the fresco. The cardinal was livid, and he complained to the Pope, demanding that his face be removed from the painting. The pontiff joked that his jurisdiction extended into purgatory, but not into hell, so his portrait would have to remain. Nearly five centuries later, you can see this today. The poor guy is immortalized. So the moral of the story is, don't cross Michelangelo. The entire scene is one of terror and drama, which ushered in a new era of art known as Baroque. The Baroque style of art is more dramatic than Renaissance art, using movement, exuberance, passion, grandeur, and surprise to give the viewers a sense of awe. And there are plenty of examples to see this in Rome, starting with the master of Baroque, Gian Lorenzo Bernini. Now, I've been rambling on and on about how amazing Michelangelo is and all of his work that's being displayed throughout Rome. We also need to talk about the master of Baroque, which followed on the heels of the Renaissance. And the master of Baroque is definitely Gian Lorenzo Bernini. His fingerprints, as well as Michelangelo's, are all over St. Peter's Basilica. Most notably in the centerpiece, which I touched on earlier, a 7-story pavilion-like canopy that towers above the altar. This was intended to mark in a monumental way the place of St. Peter's tomb underneath. It features 4 spiraling, twisting bronze pillars. They look like corkscrews, and they're almost 70 feet in height. It's over the top. It's crazy dramatic. It's grandiose. It's pure Baroque. Bernini also designed St. Peter's Square in front of the Basilica. It's a square that's not a square at all. It's a perfectly symmetrically balanced, enclosed, semicircular collection of enormous Doric columns, 4 columns deep, which are intended, in the words of Bernini, to embrace the visitor in the maternal arms of the Mother Church. How many columns? How about 284? Add to that, 130-foot Egyptian obelisk, which was pilfered from Egypt by Emperor Caligula, and it sits in the center of the square, and add to it a spectacular Bernini fountain, and you have a piece of pure Baroque architecture meant to impress and to overawe. Now, I'm not going to say that Bernini was a better sculptor than Michelangelo, although some might argue that point, but he was definitely more dramatic. And when you go to Rome, you really ought to do a bit of a Bernini tour. Of course, you'll see his work at St. Peter's, but I have to suggest 2 other Bernini sites that will absolutely blow you away. See if you can visit, first of all, the Church of Santa Maria della Vittoria. This church is slathered with Baroque richness, highlighted by Bernini's signature masterpiece, this statue, The Ecstasy of St. Teresa. Okay, I got to prepare you for this one. It's a statue of St. Teresa who has just been stabbed with God's arrow of fire. An angel is pulling it out and watching her reaction. We're going to call the sculpture theatrically vivid. You'll see what I mean in a minute here. Teresa swoons. Her eyes roll up. Her hand goes limp. She parses her lips and moans. It's been described as the sweetness of intense pain. Others say she has been charged with spiritual arousal. Still others suggest it's a different kind of arousal, as it's difficult to miss the erotic nature of this statue. Bernini has been accused of crossing a line of decency by sexualizing the saint's experience to a degree that no artist before or after Bernini dared to do. Teresa is an idealized, delicate beauty, in a semi-prostrate position with her mouth open, her legs splayed apart. I'm telling you, it's a scene. You might say it's got a strong PG rating, but it will make an impression on you, and that is the whole point of Baroque art. Now, the passion that Bernini brought to his work came from his heart, as his private life was as theatrically vivid as his art. How about this? In the 1630s, he had an affair with a woman named Costanza, who was the wife of his workshop assistant. At the height of their romance, Bernini sculpted a bust of her, which you can see today at the Bargello Museum in Florence. Now, this Costanza must have been a fairly lusty lass, because she went on later to have an affair with Bernini's younger brother, Luigi, who was Bernini's right-hand man in his studio at the time. When Bernini found out about this affair, he had his servant go to Costanza's house, where the servant slashed her several times in the face with a razor. To add insult to injury, Costanza was also jailed for adultery. What about Bernini's crime of ordering the face lashing? Well, he had a bit of pull with the Pope, so he was exonerated. Bernini managed to get over the incident, and at the age of 41, he married a 22-year-old girl, nearly half his age, who went on to bear him 11 children. Although Bernini's history of scandalous behavior was out there, he was still able to maintain the patronage of all the extravagantly wealthy and powerful people in Rome, most notably the powerful Cardinal Scipione Borghese. Scipione was, take a guess, a nephew of Pope Paul V. He was appointed to numerous ecclesiastical positions, each of which paid Scipione enormous stipends, so much so that he was able to purchase almost anything he wanted, including entire towns. But Scipione's real passion was art. He was an avid collector, and he used his wealth and considerable influence to purchase, extort, or expropriate masterpieces wherever they could be found. One of his strategies was to threaten his marks with excommunication from the Roman Catholic Church, courtesy of his uncle, Pope Paul, unless they, quote, donated their artwork to Scipione. He was able to acquire what became the greatest private collection of art in human history. It was all displayed in his magnificent Renaissance palace, the Villa Borghese. Scipione was particularly enthralled with Bernini and sponsored much of his work, which is in this collection today. So in the Villa Borghese, which you really must see when you're in Rome, there are a few pieces that really stand out. One is Bernini's David. You're probably familiar with Michelangelo's David, which is in Florence, and that is a classic example of high Renaissance art. Now, this is a larger-than-life male nude with a stoic, purposeful expression on his face as he sets out to slay Goliath. Bernini's David is not classic High Renaissance, it is classic Baroque, full of movement, energy, and drama. Again, it's theatrically vivid. Incidentally, the face of David is a self-portrait of the 25-year-old Bernini, so when you see the statue, you'll see what this guy looked like. But the highlight of the collection, in my opinion, is the absolutely exquisite Apollo and Daphne. It depicts a scene where Apollo, who has been struck by Cupid's arrow, falls desperately in love with the beautiful Daphne. He pursues her and finally manages to get her into his grasp. Daphne isn't really keen on hooking up with Apollo, so she calls to her father to save her. Magically, her fingers begin to sprout leaves, her toes become roots, her skin turns into bark as she transforms into a tree. In true Baroque fashion, Bernini freezes the scene at its most dramatic, emotional moment. You got to see the statue. And when you do, walk around it 360 degrees. It seems to be more air than stone. Works like this demonstrated how Bernini far outshone other sculptors of his generation and was broadly considered as Michelangelo's worthy successor. Is Bernini superior to Michelangelo? Does he surpass Il Divino? Go to Rome, have a look at both of them, and decide for yourself. Renaissance versus Baroque, noble, heroic versus dramatic and theatrical. There's no wrong answer. Now, I can't recommend the Villa Borghese highly enough. In addition to the Bernini's, there's a treasure trove of jaw-dropping art in the collection. You'll see some of Raphael's finest paintings there. And there's an amazing sculpture by Canova of Napoleon's sister Pauline reclining in the nude. And this sculpture scandalized Europe. There are several other works by Caravaggio, who was another bad boy of the art world that you won't want to miss. And the best thing about the Borghese is that it won't be crowded because they limit admission by requiring that visitors reserve in advance for your two-hour visit. You can do it online. It's easy to do. And even if you forget about the art, the Villa Borghese building itself is spectacular and worth the price of admission all on its own. Not only that, the villa is situated on the 200-acre Borghese Gardens. Our friend Scipione converted it from a vineyard to an English-style landscape garden, and today it is the third largest garden in Rome. It's a great place to walk, to rent bikes, enjoy the ponds and water features, visit the villas, which are sprinkled throughout the garden. Last time I was there, we had a picnic in the Borghese Gardens. It was fantastic. Great way to chill out and relax in between all the business of visiting the amazing attractions that Rome has to offer. How many days do you need to properly see the Eternal City? Starting with the Caesar Shuffle through Imperial Rome, you'll need a few days for the Forum, the Colosseum, the Pantheon, Castel Sant'Angelo, Catacombs, Mamertine Prison, Piazza Navona, Nero's Golden House, and others. And you'll need a few more days for the glories of Renaissance Rome that we talked about in the Renaissance Rome Ramble, the Vatican Museum with the Laocoon, including Raphael's School of Athens, and of course the Sistine Chapel with the Last Judgment and the Sistine Ceiling of Michelangelo. And you can't miss St. Peter's Basilica with Michelangelo's Pietà, his glorious dome, Bernini's canopy, and many other highlights in the interior that I haven't even mentioned. And there's still Michelangelo's Moses you need to see, Bernini's Ecstasy of St. Teresa, and the ridiculously rich collection at the Borghese Gallery. That is a lot to take in. And there are a lot of things we still haven't even touched on. When you're in Rome, go for a passeggiata, which is an evening stroll down the Via Corso. It's a very Roman thing to do. Have an amazing al fresco meal at an outdoor restaurant. Then you can meander past the Trevi Fountain en route to the Spanish Steps, where you can spend the evening eating gelato and people watching. As I suggested off the top in episode 1, I can't imagine any other European city with the density of significant and impactful attractions that have shaped Western civilization as Rome. And where does Rome rank compared to London and Paris for the best big city destination in Europe? Well, tune in over the next couple of weeks when we look at Rome. We've looked at Rome, we're going to look at London, we're going to look at Paris, and you can decide for yourself. And if you have a chance, pop onto my Instagram, Snapshots Travelog, where I posted a number of photos of some of these masterpieces that I've talked about in this Renaissance Ramble, so you can see what we're talking about, and I think a picture is worth a thousand words. So I hope you get a chance to do that, and in the meantime, keep calm and travel on.